This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Greetings, and our guests tonight are Tahu McKenzie, who's our local superstar here in Dunedin, and Harry Penfold, who is a second-year production design student, but who's also just won the Audacious Business Award for a very amazing product, which we'll talk about later. So, but first, for my number of the week, which is 40. This is 40 degrees centigrade. That is the temperature experienced across Europe in August, known as the Lucifer heatwave, and Sam may have experienced some of that because he was over there during that period, but it struck mostly the southeast of France, Italy and Croatia in early August. So the Lucifer heatwave saw temperatures fail to drop below 30 degrees centigrade for 3 days and nights in the hottest spots, and was linked to a 15% surge in emergency hospital admissions in Italy. Prolonged heat is known to be very dangerous to health, and severe heatwave in Europe in 2003 was linked to 75,000 deaths by subsequent analysis. Yeah. So scorching temperatures across Europe's Mediterranean nations this summer were made at least 10 times more likely by climate change, according to scientists. So furthermore, without action to tackle global warming, such summer heat waves with temperature soaring over 40 degrees centigrade will become normal by 2050. So summers keep getting hotter, says Frederic Hotto from the University of Oxford in the UK. Now, heat waves are far more intense than when my parents were growing up in the 1950s. If we do nothing to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, the kind of extreme heat that we saw this past summer will be the norm when my young son is a grown man, said Dr. Otto. So the fast-growing science of climate change attribution tackles the question of what impact global warming is having on extreme weather and the people it affects. So no event itself can be said to be caused by climate change because random extremes occur naturally. But by comparing extremes with historical measurements and computer models of a climate unaltered by carbon emissions, researchers can show how global warming is already heavily loading the dice of dangerous weather, making it more likely each year. And we've seen that with the hurricanes in the US. You've had two huge hurricanes which have had extreme weather events there. Now, in June, the scientists showed the extreme weather event heatwave that saw deadly forest fires blazing in Portugal and Spain was made 10 times more likely by global warming as well. And in Portugal, 64 people died, in fact, from those fires as a result of that heat wave. And previous work has demonstrated floods in England and France, even as far back as 2000, were made more significantly likely by climate change. So we've got heat waves, you've got forest fires, you have floods, but the whole works here. So research in Australia has shown that bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef was 175 times more likely due to greenhouse gas emissions, while the recent hot winter was made 60 times more likely. So we're seeing more extreme events right across the globe. And in June, the Guardian newspaper had a report that the UK government's failure to update building regulations for homes, hospitals and schools could cause a tripling of heat deaths by 2040 because there's no air conditioning in all these buildings, allowing people to escape the really critical heat. And it's critical that cities work with scientists and public health experts, because there's a huge public health risk, to develop heat action plans, because such extreme heat will become the norm in the middle of the century, said Robert Fautard, a researcher at the Laboratory of Climate and Environmental Sciences in France. Climate change is impacting communities right now, and these plans will save lives. So that's my number of the week, which always seems very...
You asked if I experienced that, and the answer is no, because I was in Cornwall and North Wales and Sweden, where it didn't get above 23 degrees the whole time I was there. And you see, there's the problem, that this global warming thing, warmer summer sounds like a nice idea. 40 degrees might be pushing it. But do you think we've still got an image problem with this warming problem?
Yeah, I think we just, I mean, it's, we should call it climate change or climate catastrophe or climate crisis or something. Warming, although accurate, doesn't quite describe the frosty of us and the thank you, Tahu. and the actual impact it's going to have on our society. So I think, yeah, we need to change the name of the problem, don't we? Anyway.
We'll make it go away, though.
No, it won't, but it might make people take some more action, because even though people are experiencing the direct effects of climate change, for instance, in the United States or Florida, people still are not believing that it's happening. It's like this refusal to change their worldview, despite the fact that, you know, the world is actually changing around them as a result of these things, and they just refuse to accept the facts. And it's kind of one of those hangovers from our Stone Age brains that is kind of hampering our ability to cope with the 21st century.
Sort of talk about yourself and your Stone Age brain.
All right, okay, cool. So what we're going to do is have a word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Fantastic. Okay, so our guests tonight are Tahu McKenzie, who by day is an education officer and a native bird wrangler at Orkanui Eco Sanctuary, and by night is one of Dunedin's superstars, a singer, performer and personality extraordinaire. She is known about town for fabulous dresses and costumes and always adorned with glitter and feathers, as she is tonight. And although she's dressed down a little bit, but she still has a glitter and the wonderful makeup on, as wonderful eyelashes, and I've never seen her not smiling. Which I always see Tahu, she's always smiling. She's a keen environmentalist and has won several local awards for education, and was one of only 30 people from across the globe to attend the Roots and Shoots Symposium at Windsor Castle in London, run by Jane Goodall Institute in 2015. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And our other guest tonight is Harvey Penfold. Now, Harvey's a second year production design student, but has done the amazing thing of winning the Audacious Business Award for 2017. Congratulations, Harry, for an amazing design that's going to help our native birds. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
So we're going to start off with you, Tahu, because ladies first. And so were you born here in Dunedin? Tell us your story.
I was born here in Dunedin, very, very lucky. And I grew up on the peninsula in Broad Bay, up a tree or in the sea, until I was 7 years old, and every Sunday we'd go to Allen's Beach. And so I had a very, very strong nature connection from day one, and that's really where I find my inspiration. And then my wonderful, beautiful mother, whom I love and adore, is a medical law lecturer, and at that time was doing feminist jurisprudence law, so she couldn't get full-time work here in Dunedin. And so we became economic migrants. And when I was 7, we went from Broad Bay to LA, South Central, Los Angeles.
Oh, that would be a bit of a difference.
And then we went to Glasgow. And then we went to London. So I went from being very, very immersed in nature to being very, very immersed in cities. And that was a big shock to my system. And I would dream about returning to Allen's Beach, being a bird and flying over the land. And I always wanted to come back here. And I was very lucky that when we lived in Scotland, we spent some time at a really beautiful place, Finlayston Manor, and we lived in the servants' quarters, and we had to climb up 164 stone steps to get to the top. But there was an adventure playground there, and there was a lady there called Paula, who was amazing, and it was her job to engage all the children that came to visit with nature. And so she'd take us all around and show us frogs and tadpoles and trees and all these things. And you can imagine that I was her absolute number one fan and just followed her around and collected lots of dead moles and things to show her. And you can imagine it. So that was at 8. So that was a big, big inspiration moment for me. And I grew up in England, in Kent, in Canterbury, the big cathedral. And I got involved with tourism there. So I used to show people around the cathedral based on what I'd learned from school trips to, you know, make a bit of pocket money, basically.
Yeah.
So that interpretation and that desire to tell the stories of a place started quite early on as well. And then when I finished school, I came back here. And I was really, really lucky that I got a job out at the Marine Studies Centre at Portobello. And that was a huge life-changing thing for me, because in England, obviously, you're surrounded by human stories a lot of the time. And I'd done a lot of theatre and performing and everything like that, telling those human stories. But it wasn't until I started working at the aquarium and I was telling the stories of the animals and the stories of the sea that I really found what I want to do for the rest of my life. So it was really cool. And I worked there for 4 years, and I did education there and looked after the animals there. And then I was really lucky to be offered the amazing, amazing dream job position of developing the education program at Otokonui. So that was 8 years ago. And we've been so lucky that we've had that LEOTC funding, learning experiences outside of the classroom funding, from the Ministry of Education. And we've been able to not cost the sanctuary anything, but every student that visits contributes $5 to the running of the sanctuary. And we're also really lucky that we have a roaming contract, so we can work with schools anywhere, we can work with early childhood, we can work with university groups anywhere, and so we can really help people restore their own immediate ecosystems as well as coming to visit us for inspiration. And it's been a wonderful learning journey for me. I've met so many amazing, inspirational scientists and people from all different walks of life that are united by that love of nature and that vision of restoration for the future and sustainable practice. And I've loved connecting with the Polytech in that way. And we're really happy because we just found out that we have our LEOTC funding for another 3 years, and just found that out yesterday.
Oh,
so we're so happy. And at this stage we have around 7,000 students every year and around 19,000 visitors from the public every year. So we're continuing to grow as a place to come and see the beautiful wildlife.
Tell us a little bit about Orokanuki Sanctuary, because a lot of our listeners are actually overseas and so they wouldn't know anything about it, or even local people might know so much about it. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, up until about 20 years ago in New Zealand, if you wanted to be able to see an endangered species, you'd have to have lots of money and you'd have to have a permit from DOC and you'd have to get on a boat and go to a little offshore island where all the introduced pests and predators had been removed, and then you could hope to see them. And then about 20 years ago, Karori Eco Sanctuary, which is now Zealandia in Wellington, was established. And this really inspired a whole new wave of conservation technology in New Zealand. So we're so lucky that the wonderful Diane Campbell Hunt, who we remember, who sadly passed away, but we remember, helped to establish Otokonui, having been involved with Zealandia. And so we were established in 2007. The fence was finished. And we were able to begin translocating species back. So we created a pest-free, safe environment for them. And we're actually 10 years in to a 1,000-year restoration plan, which is just amazing and I find so inspiring. So we've brought back beautiful, beautiful species like kaka that have been extinct for 120 years in Dunedin. We've brought back Haastokweka kiwi, so the rarest kiwi species in New Zealand, and we're also a kiwi creche. So we get the babies when they're almost 2 months old and they've been raised and hatched in a lab. When they come to us, it's the first time they've been outside and they have to learn to fend for themselves, and we feed them as well. And then when they're about a year old, they go off to one of those pest-free islands. And in the time that I've been at Otokonui, that population's gone from 300 Haastokweka kiwi to 400. So it's just amazing.
That's incredible, yeah.
The difference these sanctuaries make. And my favourite to come back, extinct for 400 years locally and thought to be extinct and then rediscovered, the takahi. So we're really lucky that we have 5 takahi now, and paku, the mum, is on an egg.
Wow.
Very exciting. So it's a wonderful, wonderful learning environment for students, and that's what I'm really passionate about. But it's also for scientists nationally and internationally a really fascinating place to study. So it's a living experiment, it's a living laboratory, and we have scientists from all over the world coming there and collecting data to help others.
Wow, so it is basically essentially a huge fence surrounding a forest. Mm. It's been now how what kind of was that already native bush? There's been some introduced species and stuff in there. So how do you manage all that? How do you kind of recreate an environment? Mm. How does that happen?
Mm. It's a really interesting process, and it is a long and gradual process. So what we had to do was look at several sites, and we chose that site, or the Otago Natural History Trust chose that site, because it has a beautiful stream that runs through it. It has a large area of broadleaf and podocarp forest that is, you know, many thousands of years old. That's remnant forest there. And the really cool thing about broadleaf and podocarp forest is it feeds birds in the winter. And podocarps, of course, live for 1,000 years. So that was very precious. However, the rest of the valley has been somewhat decimated. So there was a big fire that whipped up about 200 years ago. So there's a lot of monocultures of kānuka there. But that's really good for insectivorous birds. So lots of robins and tomtits and fantails. And the all the time. Amazing.
That was just Tahu just made that bird noise right there and then. But I don't know how she did it. She did
I
it
believe
something.
In you. So you do the kissy noise. You have to give it a go. The kissy noise. Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. And then lick your lips. Yes. Yes. And then get your knuckles. And you've got to bend the sound with your knuckles.
Oh, you're better at it than us.
Practice makes perfect.
Yeah, I think we need a lot of practice there.
You can do it.
Sorry, carry on. Sorry, the tomtits.
Lots of beautiful little insectivorous birds making those sounds, which you will learn to make very soon. And also within that area, we have a road. So we have access, even though it's out of town. It would be much, much better if it was smack bang in the middle of town, like Zealandia, but we do have that road access there. So that's one of the reasons that site was chosen. And actually, Sam Neill, the famous actor and everything, his great-great-grandfather owned the land, and he was very naughty, and he brought in rabbits and quails and deer and all these things, and it was his private hunting reserve.
Oh, wow.
So when we first started, it was fantastic because we could say, "Oi, Sam Neill, you know, come on, help us out." And he did, like, the voiceover for our funding ads and stuff. So I think that really helped to fundraise. And it was great because we fundraised for the fence, which was $2.2 million. We fundraised for the visitor centre, which was $1.1 million. We got all of that. So in terms of starting off, we did really, really well. We didn't have any debt. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what does this fence look like? I mean, what would it, you know, walking up to it? What makes it? What does it have to cope with?
It has to cope with a constant barrage of introduced predators trying to get through, and they're really, really smart, and they're really, really crafty and opportunistic. So sometimes they do get through.
So, what kind of things like that are they? Are you talking about bears or?
Oh, not naughty bears.
Crocodiles.
Crocodiles.
You never know what the future may bring, touch wood. You won't have any of that. But stoats, goats, ferrets, weasels, possums, rats, cats, dogs, hedgehogs, all of those introduced predators are trying to get through. Mice are our worst problem. So the fence is made from a beautiful mesh and the holes are only 6 millimetres. So you shouldn't be able to get even a baby mouse through, but because of the wind and all these things, that mesh can change shape. We have a team of volunteers that are constantly going around the fence line looking for those changes, and then they patch it up. But mice are one that are very tricky. So we've just had a really big operation putting out 2,660 bait stations to try to get rid of all the mice, and it looks like it's gone pretty well, but it's an ongoing battle. The worst one that happened, really, this really, really bad, was a couple of years ago when we had a big, big dump of snow and the beautiful hood that comes down on the outside of the fence that's really slippery and overhangs the fence. So if a possum or a cat tries to jump up, they slip off. Or if a climbing animal like a rat or a stoat climbs up, they can't flip themselves over, they can't get a grip.
All right.
And unfortunately what happened with the snow was that it turned to ice. And when it turned to ice, a stoat could get a grip on it, or so we think, flipped itself over, got in, and ate all the saddleback that we had.
All of them?
All of them.
Saddleback is a bird.
Very, very rare. Very, very rare bird. So we were the only place on the mainland that had saddleback. And they all got eaten in a few days. from one state. So they're absolutely ferocious, these predators, and they're so highly evolved. And our native birds just have no defence against them. And particularly birds like the saddleback that have long evolved around avian predators, not mammalian predators. They nest on the ground. And when you show them a model of a stoat or a model of a cat or a model of a rat, they just come and, you know, peck at it. They don't have any fear response at all. So it's a really interesting battle, but it is an ongoing battle.
So have you been able to get more saddlebacks?
We're trying.
Okay.
It's going to be a lot harder now.
Because obviously losing them, people don't want to, no, we don't want to give you any more of our birds.
But yeah, we really hope that we can. Mm. And we've done very, very well with our other species. So what we do now, when it snows, straight away, is we get in the quad bike and we have like a really, really big broom, like one of those really wide brooms, and we drive around the whole 9 kilometres of the fence and sweep off all the snow. That's very exciting.
But you must have a hugely dedicated group of volunteers who look after this, and, you know, a huge amount of time. I mean, is there like a little army of them?
Yes, yeah. There are several armies. It's incredible. And that is really because it's a community-led eco-sanctuary. So we're not run by the government. We're not run by, you know, the Department of Conservation, anything like that. We're run by the community. And that all started with Diane Campbell-Hunt. So she held 42 public meetings right at the start, and she got everyone engaged. All the residents in Waitati have a key. They can come in and out whenever they like. And so that sense of engagement and ownership has really been there since day one. And we have 2,000 hours every month.
That's
from
huge.
Our volunteers.
That's going to be the challenge, isn't it, if you're talking about a 100-year restoration plan,
yeah.
Or a 1,000-year restoration plan? How do we maintain that over the long haul?
Mm.
Which is partly, my next question is, what is it that you're teaching people when they're there?
Mm.
And that's kind of one of the big questions that we want to engage people in.
I think that we're teaching people what they can do. I think we're teaching people what has been lost and what can come back and how easy it is. Yeah, so for example, over the last few years, we've been so lucky that all of these other groups have got involved to help us. So we have the Beyond Otokonui project, which is a HALO project, and that's Reese Miller, fantastic. So it's all those surrounding communities around the eco-sanctuary getting on board, trapping, feeding birds, monitoring for pests in their backyard and their environments. And that way we know the kaka are flying out. We know the saddleback did jump over the fence. We know the robins are flying out. And those pre-existing populations that have grown and grown and grown, like your tuis and bellbirds, of course they're flying out. They have really big home ranges. So it's amazing when you have that support from the local community, they're going to be safe, a lot safer when they hop over the fence. So,
and that's the best defence against the barrage on the fence.
Absolutely.
Is to move that a long way further back.
Absolutely. And we recently were so happy because the Valley Project have come on board helping us with the Valley Open Urban Eco Sanctuary, or Open View, and that's an extension of that HALO. And very soon there's going to be a similar initiative in the Town Belt. So it's all just connecting. You know, it's really beautiful. And we've seen in Wellington with Zealandia the power of this community action, renaturing environments, renaturing people's neighbourhoods. So, you know, you do have kaka on your deck and they're safe, you know.
So what does a kaka look like?
They're a big, beautiful parrot, and they're really, really curious and charismatic and amazing. And they have, there's lots of myths and legends about them stealing fire or bringing fire down to earth or stealing the orange feathers from kakariki, because they're quite brown and green and grey and orange on their back. So they're really well camouflaged from the avian predator looking down at them from above, the harst eagle. But when they want to show off, they can do a big wah and they bring out their wings, and they've got all this amazing fiery orange red under their wings, and they've got this big strong hooked beak, so they look quite, you know, they look quite scary a wee bit. But actually inside that big hooked beak is a beautiful soft nectar feeding paintbrush tongue. And so they'll come and sit on your shoulder and they'll lick your nose and they'll lick your lips and lick your eyebrows and everything like that, and then they put the oil on their feathers. So it's an amazing beauty treatment. I'd recommend it to everyone. And so they are actually very gentle and very crafty.
That's incredible.
You said a big inspirational moment for you was when you were inspired by Paula at, where was it, Scotland, Findlayston Manor. Now you're doing that sort of work. Do you notice that kind of kids picking it up?
Yes.
And is this, is there anything in particular that works?
I think they want to feel heard as an individual. And they want to feel connected with as an individual. And I think that's really important. So I think it's really important to ask them what they really love and what inspires them from nature first, before you do anything else, and learn a bit more about them, what really interests them, and give them the opportunity to explore themselves a wee bit, so you're not trying to direct the experience too much.
So when they turn up on the bus,
mm-hmm.
what do you do first?
We do like a big welcome and everything. We do a big mefakatone song and everything and get them all moving round. And then depending on the size of the group, we might do a circle where we go around and they say their name and they say what they love from nature, and then they come down and give thanks to the earth and jump up and give thanks to the sky and then thank each other. So it's very like dynamic, but that does depend on the size of the group. But yes, it's definitely what I want to do is really engage the whole person in the experience, and I want to give them a very, very rewarding emotional experience, because I believe so much in nature therapy, and my biggest therapy and healing has come from nature connection. So I'm really lucky that I get to work with social workers in schools, and we have a cool program called Kaka Club. So it's for children that have been identified as at risk, or you know, they're working through some things personally. And what I want to give them is the ability to have that nature connection for their whole life, so they have that grounding and that mindfulness, however you want to couch it, so that when they need to feel support and they need to feel strong, that they know that it comes from nature all the time and that's always there for them. So yeah, big nature therapy stuff there, and I see that happening. So I see when the kids come in, it's very exciting for them to see this big, you know, wide open space and all these trees and all these things like that. But then it's also that moment of calm and peacefulness when they're listening to the birds and everything like that. And I'm really lucky at the moment that I have an intern from the social work department, and she's looking at that. She's looking at the therapeutic benefits of a place like Otokonui for all ages of people. But she'll ask them, you know, what do you really like about nature? And always, always, we get these great responses from the kids, even early childhood. And they'll say, I feel really calm, you know?
Do you send them away with an action list?
Yes, and so all the groups that come, generally it's based on the action learning cycle. So they will have, at school or at their centre, wherever they're based, they will have something that they want to do after coming to Otokonui. So it might be like a stream clean-up, or setting up a bird feeder, or doing some tracking or doing some trapping. So we're really there as a case study for them and to upskill them. And we can help them post-visit, so we can go and help them set everything up.
Oh, wow. So they're not just coming to, like, see the birds, see the fence?
No, they're coming as part of a bigger process, which is really important.
That's cool. Mm. And it's funded on that basis?
Yes. And that roaming contract really helps, so we can keep in touch with them. And with this project that we've been working on, this is the beginning of a longitudinal study. So this is the largest longitudinal study that we've established, but we've established longitudinal studies with schools, but this is like a whole community longitudinal study. So it's saying what birds are here, what pests and predators are here. The next phase that we've just gone in for funding for is going to look at what skinks and or geckos, what invertebrates are there. And so we're really building up that baseline data that we had to build up at the start of Otokonui. So yes, it's an open eco-sanctuary, but it's still an area being mapped and understood in terms of populations.
So the whole idea of that is to integrate the native species back into the localities, you know, where people live.
Mm.
I mean, because we have caribou coming into our garden, and We have like, I think we have three, and they keep flying into our garden all the time.
Doing the best poos in the world.
Yes, exactly.
100 baby trees.
And they're fantastic. They're the curlew, like the native wood pigeon here. They're like a giant, big, fat pigeon. And they're quite clumsy, but they're very funny. And so we've been trapping possums.
Yes.
I've killed a couple this weekend. Two huge ones.
Well done.
And get the third. There's another one in the garden.
He talks about his garden as if he's got the green thumb.
I know. I have the opposite of a green thumb. It's a wilderness garden.
You have an opposable thumb, and that's very useful. Mm.
Yeah, Sam's a good gardener. I'm not.
Okay, Harvey, you're up.
Yep. Right. Yeah. Come on, let's talk to you about you, Harry. So, what's your? Tell us about yourself. Where were you? Where were you born?
I was born in the UK. Manchester.
All right. Wow. So, brought you to New Zealand. Tell us the story.
So, my parents came over here when I was only 8 months old, and I was raised in the Wairarapa in the small town Featherston. I stayed there till I was about 21, mm-hmm. before I came down here, and I came down here because I met Tahu. And, so I came down here to be with her, was really nice.
And so you came down here and you decided to do a bit of study when you're down here, so...
Yeah.
What attracted you to design?
I always, like to think about making new things and inventions and stuff. And when I was younger, I thought I wanted to be an inventor.
You are an inventor.
I just never really knew about product design, wasn't aware that there was like courses in it and stuff. So when I came down here, I was just like working as a builder for a while, and then Tahu actually found the course, and I was like, wow, that's awesome, and went and checked it out. And then just enrolled in it and have been loving it ever since.
Wow. So tell us a bit about this this award. So, and what is the design? So tell us a bit about the design thing and then tell us about the award.
Yeah,
so what did you design?
We designed a bird feeding platform that goes on a waratah. And
what's a waratah, by the way?
A waratah is basically a metal stick that you stick in the ground.
Cool.
Sort of thing. Now that came out of the Valley project. So originally we weren't even thinking about, selling this thing or making money. We just did it for them, sort of as a freebie kind of thing. And it was, really successful. And Mitre 10 sponsored all the gear for that project. And when they saw the feeder and how successful it was and stuff, they suggested that they could sell it. And then we did a round of 50 for them, and they sold out. And then I entered the design into Audacious,
mm-hmm.
As part of my project, and we won it. So,
oh, fantastic! Yeah. Now, yay, brilliant! Congratulations!
Yeah.
Hey, so what makes this different from the normal bird feeder? Is what's special about it?
Well, probably like the biggest draw card for it is that it accommodates two different feeders at the same time, which was one of the requirements for when we originally made it for the Valley project. And it uses like one of the better sugar water feeders, which Orokino uses, but they can be quite difficult for people to set up, but this just makes it so much easier for the birds. And it's a lot cheaper than other stuff as well. So
because a lot of native birds are nectar feeders, right?
Yeah. So that's a thing of native birds, is that a lot of them are nectar feeders.
Okay, and what's the other thing that they can feed off? So you've got the nectar feeder, and then you've got the...
Yeah, then you've got like a hook on the underneath the platform. You can pretty much put anything you want on there. You can put a fat feeder, a seed feeders, and you can get any kind of combination. Pretty much like whatever birds you've got around, you can target them with the food on with that system.
So this feeder then is part of that project of enabling the native birds to establish themselves and getting them through those rough periods when there's not enough food around.
So what we had to do was, in order to quantify the populations, was set up these standardized feeders that could host the sugar water, all the fat, all the fruit, all the seed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we set up a trail cam, 1.5 metres away from that feeder. And so every bird that was coming in, we were getting a photo of. And we did this with more than 130 families in the valley.
Wow.
So part of building up that population picture was us and just 3D printing these platforms. And we had no idea it would be a product and be sold. But as Harvey said, so many birds were able to come in and use them. And what I really love about them is that they very quickly teach each other. And so we set up one in our back garden while this project was going on, and within 5 minutes it was covered in silver eyes. And we've had people tell us, I've had 50 silver eyes at once on these feeders.
Wow.
And because, like Harvey was saying, with the sugar water bottle, it's a fantastic design. It doesn't leak, doesn't attract bees, it's very hygienic for the birds and things like that. But it's quite tricky for them to figure out how to use it. They'll take a wee while. But with this system, because you have the fat feeder or the fruit feeder there, the silver eyes come in because they're very inquisitive. They'll quickly figure out how to use the sugar water feeder. And then tuis and bellbirds who are more wary will be watching them and hearing them and everything and seeing them. And then they'll start to come in. So in terms of bringing birds into your backyard, for a lot of people, that hasn't been an option. There hasn't been a sort of feeder that will work for them economically or in their garden. They might not have trees, you know, in their garden mm-hmm. and things. And this, because it's on that Waratah, you can take it anywhere. So we've had kindies buying them. I want to have them at Ross Home, you know, for elderly people. So it's just so much entertainment and pleasure from watching these birds come in.
And you're getting support from the local Mitre 10?
Yes. Yeah, so we're very lucky we've got a really good relationship with them, and they're very community-oriented. So they've always helped the sanctuary, and they were part of the Takahi restoration plan and things like that. And so they sponsored us all the feeders, all the waratahs, all the food for that citizen science project, which was amazing. And then we were able to work in with them, selling the platforms. And so we have workshops there next week. It's very exciting. Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday will be in the store, and we've got some hands-on sessions making things with people at 11 and 1 o'clock, and those workshops are free, and we will be selling the platforms and the feeders and everything there. And for each one sold, a donation will be made to Otokonui. So it's fantastic.
Wow. That's fantastic. How much are they going to be?
$45. So for $45, you get the waratah, you get the sugar water feeder, and you get the platform, which is amazing. And then you can add your own feeder combination to that. So you might want to add a fat feeder or a fruit feeder or a seed feeder.
That's absolutely fantastic.
Now, in the first round of Audacious, Harvey entered several things. Tell us about the other things you entered.
Yeah, so for the first round, it was like generating ideas for businesses, so you could go pretty wild with your ideas. So I had a cycling jacket, which was one of the ideas, and that was for cyclists, and that would have like indicators and stuff on it, and so left and right buttons and brake lights adjusted for your bike. So that was one of the ideas. Then I had this other idea, which was this, I called it a selfie suit. And it was for people at the gym or even any sports person. And it would correct your form and the way you use the weights and stuff at the gym to give you like perfect form, like as if a virtual sort of personal trainer. And the bird feeder, I had a bird feeder idea. And that was just to target native species. Basically, it was almost like mimic natural forms a lot more. So,
yeah. Where do all these ideas come from?
I don't know. I just like, kind of just randomly think of them.
But what sort of drives you in coming up with the ideas? What's the? You trying to fix something or?
Yeah, usually trying to make something better, and like with ideas, you don't have to be able to go and make it, so you can think of some futuristic thing that doesn't even exist, and it's just an idea.
I suppose this one came very much from the Valley Project had a particular need.
Mm. Yeah, so yeah, that's kind of like, I enjoy that as well when someone says, oh, I need something to do this and that, and, you know, give you this list of requirements, and then you design something for that, which is what happened with the Valley project, is that they said it needs to be on a Waratah, it needs to be able to accommodate a sugar water feeder and a fat feeder. So we started drawing stuff, coming up with ideas, and then the end result was this platform feeder that we've created. Yeah.
So Audacious, which didn't mention, Audacious is the student business entrepreneurship competition run between the City Council, the Polytech, and the university. Yeah. What did you win?
We won $5,000 investment, which is pretty sweet.
Awesome.
We got $1,500 worth of legal advice, $3,000 worth of website creating design, and a phone from Vodafone and a 12-month plan, and a $100 printing voucher, which is pretty awesome prizes. It's pretty big.
Where's that going to take you?
It's pretty much going to take us straight into production and starting, you know, a fully functioning, profitable business. So, yeah, it's pretty good. And it's probably going to happen fairly quickly.
Are you seeing a business that's focusing on environmental things like this? Or?
Yeah, so we're planning on this being one of the first products in a range of products. So we'll reinvest profits into creating new designs. And eventually I might get to making the bird feeder that I entered in the first round, which is a feeder to target native birds. And might be some elaborate design of a feeder. But
and not forgetting to finish a degree.
Yeah.
Doing very well. So I've spent all day today working with amazing people in Dunedin. We're so lucky. We're so lucky with the industries here. It's incredible. So, you know, we've had all these orders. We've had to very quickly source polypropylene and water cut them. But we've been able to do that, you know, locally, everything. And
wow.
A lot of people that I know actually do all these things. I didn't realise. It's so funny. So we've had 200 cart from Otago Sheet Metal, and Blasted from Blasting and Coating in Kaiapoi Valley. And so they'll all be ready for these workshops next week, which is fantastic. And we're also having an injection moulding tool made in Mosgiel for us by JTech. So it's amazing to be able to do it all locally and with lovely, helpful people.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the hidden secrets of Dunedin's, all the engineering skills we have here, of course. And, of course, that was born out of the railway industry. And the railway, you know, we had a huge railway workshop here, which looked after all the rail cars and the engines. And all those engineering skills then spilled out into the city. And, of course, we still have this engineering skills in Dunedin, which is, you know, not usual for a city of this size, but it's quite incredible. There's lots of hidden secrets in Dunedin.
It's amazing.
So where do you hope to be in a year's time?
Hopefully we're making new products in a year's time and, running our own business, making things happen.
Awesome.
We're already doing that. Yeah. So exciting, isn't it? But we're very lucky with that network of Mitre 10s. So because we have that support from Mitre 10, we want to go national with that. And there's also great companies like Top Flight that make those bird feeders, the hanging feeders. So working with companies like that as well. And that's a win-win in terms of our product and their product together. And I personally would like to see the platforms being used therapeutically. So I'd like to see them around old folks' homes, around community centres, everything like that, so that bird feeding is much more accessible for people.
Yeah, and so do the bird feeders, they'd work all over the country? Because, you know, obviously there's quite different climates and stuff, but we have similar species all the way through the country, yeah?
Yes, and there are North Island species that are nectar feeders that we don't have here.
All right.
So particularly in the North Island as well, it would be really beneficial.
Oh, wow. And so introducing those native species back into the community obviously has a huge transformational effect on the communities themselves, as well as the native fauna and flora. What are the challenges around that as well? I mean, because I know I heard some people. I heard stories in Wellington. People complaining about the caca and the birds coming and making noises. These noisy parrots coming into my garden. Mm-hmm. So, what are the challenges around that? Do you see any challenges or like
I think
cats, for instance?
Exactly. Yes, I think that's one of the big things with this design was it had to work in an urban environment. And the first round of research that we did was looking at what predators were there, and basically every household had a cat. Or the next door neighbour had a cat. So that's the reason for the waratah. That's one of the reasons for the waratah, is it's metal and they can't climb up it. And it's great visibility for the birds. So because cats are ambush predators, they need to creep up and they need to pounce. And so this feeder design means they can't do that. And because we had the trail cams there, we were able to see that in action, that all the birds could safely feed. So really cool. So that is definitely one of the challenges, is beginning that conversation with people around their pets and how we manage their pets.
How do you engage the kids in that conversation and that tension?
Well, we did a really cool project before this project with the Halo project called How Safe Is My Cat? And it was all about, okay, we want to make this area safe, so we're going to put traps out. So how do pet cats interact with traps of different kinds? And also, what do pet cats do? They're amazing hunters, but we don't know much about what they actually get up to. So what we did was we put little GPS trackers on their collars and we followed them where they were going and we calculated their home range. And similar to this project, we set up trail cams around dummy traps. So they were baited but they didn't have a trap mechanism inside. And then we saw what people's cats did around the traps. And it was really fascinating because a lot of people only see their cat when their cat's asleep. Or they only see their cat when their cat's eating cat biscuits at their house and they think, oh, my cat's so lazy and cuddly and things. And then they find out, whoa, you know, from a study like this, we were seeing home ranges of 6 hectares, 8 hectares in urban areas. And
wow,
then amazing, around the sanctuary, there was one cat called Puss Puss, who was a female cat that had been a feral cat and then domesticated, and her home range was 237 hectares, which was almost the size of the sanctuary. And that's a female cat. So a male stray cat that had been domesticated would have twice that.
That's incredible. So, and the amount of damage that cat can do.
Absolutely. So we kept prey logs as part of that study, and we also looked at feral cat poo. Yay, poo! And of course we found, you know, lizard vertebrae and bird bones and all these kinds of things, as well as the owners being brought these little presents by the cats. So that sort of project really helps. And again, in the Valley project, we've been able to begin that conversation with people too.
So apart from the incredible range some of these cats have, was there anything else surprising? Were people shocked about how
far they go at night? Yeah, so it's completely different from during the day. So they go very short distances during the day, and then at night, poof, off they go.
Wow.
Okay, so we've got some questions to end with, and we're not going to repeat them all, so we'll just have to decide who's going to answer each one. First, fingers on the buzzer. What is your go-to definition of sustainability?
Probably a closed loop production cycle, which means companies like Apple do it and Volvo do it, which means that when you have an old phone or an old car, instead of being sent to the scrapyard, it goes back to the company and the company reuses it, parts, and recycles it themselves. So what it does is it forces companies to design things so that they can be recycled, because at the end of the product's life it's going to come back to them and it's their responsibility.
So good answer from the industrial ecologist. What does the bird what does the bird ecologist say?
My thing is really that emotional connection. So starting that emotional connection and engagement with nature as your priority really early in life, and then continually renewing that. So your work is with the environment, your passion is for the environment, your emotional well-being and sacred space is found in the environment, and that is sustainable, and you're inspiring others through that.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think Audacious winning, that's probably the biggest success I've had probably in my life.
Yay. And I feel really happy about Audacious as well. And I did feel really lucky to go over to Windsor Castle as well for the Jane Goodall.
Oh, we forgot
experience.
To ask about Jane Goodall.
Yeah, did you
quickly tell us about Jane Goodall?
Yeah, I'd met her a few times before, and she'd come to Otakonui, and we launched Roots and Shoots there in 2014.
Did you totally fangirl?
Yeah, I got to hang out with her for a week, and it was really lovely. And she's really, really cool, obviously. And she loves Poirot, which is my favourite too. So we could just be like, Poirot, Poirot. So it was really cool. And it was great meeting people from all over the world that do this kind of work. It was really, really inspiring.
We are writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes.
Aww.
So what's your superpower?
Love.
Thinking about that.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes.
Yeah. In certain ways, yeah.
Do you think you'll always will be?
Yes.
Yeah.
Four questions to go. What motivates you?
That I feel the most inspired and at home and loved and powerful when I am in nature, and I want everyone to be able to feel like that.
For me, it's just being able to make your dreams sort of come true, and probably be able to work for yourself and provide a really great home life as well.
Sounds good to me. What is the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
Growing this business. I'm really loving it. It's really exciting so far, and it's a whole new creative direction for me. It's amazing. So yeah, growing it with Harvey, doing it together, it's really, really cool.
Because I wouldn't have thought that you would have said that a year or two ago.
No!
Growing a business. Yeah, that sounds like what you're going
to
do.
No, it's all thanks to him. It's amazing.
Brilliant.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would that be?
No more predators and pests introduced to New Zealand. Any of them that have been introduced, gone.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one. Go with that.
We have a goal to do that, don't we?
Yes, by 2050.
And is it sensible?
I hope so. But there's also that cool CRISPR technology, that gene editing technology. So there's lots of different ways we can look at doing it. But I think everyone needs to be on board with it.
I need some really funding, important. Doesn't it?
Yes,
it does. Money is good.
Yes, that's right.
Not just aspirations.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I would really like to encourage everyone to feel that they can make a difference. And this is, famous Jane Goodall stuff that she says, but every individual can make a difference in so many different ways. And so however you passionately connect with the world, I'd really encourage people to take action and feel really good about it.
I'd say that I found design really helpful and really cool for me to do, and that it was something that I always felt like I wanted to do, but I didn't do it for so long in my life. And that, if you feel like you enjoy something, that you should try and look for ways to make that happen.
That's fantastic. Brilliant. Okay, cheers. You're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. The show was recorded on the 28th of September 2017. Our guests were Tahu McKenzie and Harvey Penfold. Your host is Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or on oar.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.